Snap. pretend it's home and kids and go back to the farm. Watch time appreciates, look on no TV. I might go to some farm. I'm not inclined to act with harm. The title track from our new LP in your shops today. This is called Under Wraps.
Under Wraps.
Thank you.
You better tame those spotlights out there, or I'm gonna come and do it for you. This is called, and it's a song about some level of intrigue. A song set in mysterious circumstances, a parting of the ways. It's called Later That Same Evening.
Back.
Right, so we're going to get the spotlight cues, or I'm going for an early night in the bar, boys. Do as you're told, or don't do it at all. Thank you! That was called Nobody's Car. It's an unofficial introduction point. Here's a tune for that from that internationally acclaimed solo album of last year. I'm sure you all bought it. Well, maybe not. It's called Fly by Nighty Poos. Shout. I may make your bill burn accounts make you think. Your sperm's in the garden, your love's in the sink. You saw your right, your hands over the beads, and you make all your animal beads, and your wife's held up on how it feels to be thick as a brick. Sandcastle virtues are all swept away. In the title distraction, the moral of the day. The elastic retreat brings a close up. As the last wave uncovers the newfangled way. It's a shame. had you push out from the shore. Once you tell your hair was wrong, and making peace with everyone. For those who choose to stay, we live just one more day to do the things you should have done. As you cross the wilderness, you're standing in your emptiness, you feel you have to break. Looking for a sign that the universal mind is written you into the passion pain. Skating away, skating away, skating away, on a thin ice on a new day. And you cross the circle line, when the ice wall creeps behind, you're a rabbit on the run. But do you ever get the feeling that the story is too damn real and in the present tense? Or that everybody's on the stage and it seems like you're the only person sitting in the audience. Skating away. Thank you.
fat and cheese with frozen smiles, holding on steady courses. Grip the reins of history, high on their battle horses. Thank you.
Thank you very kindly. Thank you. That was called Serenade to a Cuckoo in memory of Roland Kirk. I think this moment will serve as good an opportunity as any to say hello to the boys, the good boys, good boys. First of all, normally at the drums in this next song playing the mighty bongos. He's at least 9 feet tall from New York City. Please, a big welcome to... Doan, he may get lucky tonight. Barry, Doan Perry, say hello, Doan. Hello, Doan. He's a good boy. My good boy. At the keyboards, a young man of mixed parentage. He's half Scottish and half Italian. The bottom half is Italian. It's Peter John Battesi in the keyboards. Hello, Peter. Hello, it's awfully nice to see you. He's a good boy. Now, fine and upstanding as this next gent may appear at present, in about an hour from now, he will probably be completely comatose. And once again in the grip of demon liquor. He almost gave up smoking last week. Honest Dave Pegg at the bass guitar. Hello, Dave. Oh, he's a good boy. He's a good boy. And a young man who needs no introduction. Wearing his best tie to sport in front of you all at the heavy metal mandolin, Martin Lancelot Barre. Hooray! I'm Marty Booz. Yay! He's a good boy too. Thank you kindly. This next little song reminds Martin and me of earlier years when we were possessed of more hair, slimmer hips, and huge choppers. This one's called I Don't Want to Be a Fat Man. Hey!
To go on being one here. Too much to carry around with you. No time to find anyone who without you in the morning.
wannabe Batman. People would think that I was just a fun man. Would rather be a thin man. I am so glad to go on being one. Too much to carry around with you. Hard times of finding a woman who would love you in the morning and all the night time too. Woo! We'll be right back.
and satellites passing in windows empty. And I see rocking from next up going matching a passport, credit cards, a plane that I'm catching. Like Sunday came one day to sing. A taxi that takes me, but I'm moving so quickly. A suitcase that's empty to fill for the closing. The cabs, shirts, and kisses all packed in a hurry.
Oh, Don't you start away, honey, say. Oh, you poor old salt. Oh, you see, it's only me. Oh, you know it's only a me.
Sneering, shabby. stations one by one. His woman and his best friend.
We'll see you again, no doubt, eh? Have a good Christmas. Well, as you know, we're not known as the kind of band who would ask you to join in on the choruses. But tonight, as a special treat... Oh, all right then. This one's called Too Old to Rock and Roll, Too Young to Die. So- Rock a warm inside, it's too long. You're a
to cut too tight. Old-fashioned harbor to the end. Drag his aim to light.
A dance had bound to buckle yesterday's dreams. The transport camp for Robin Upton. On the Harvey, a day could serve, and the triumph on the hill. Counted his friends in a burnt out Starbucks, a place that he always would. But he's the last of the blue blood, a grease of sound of the land. His bike to make a turn before he takes his leave. Up on the A1, Christmas corner, just like it used to be. But as he flies, tears in his eyes, his wind whirls, echo the pine of day. It's a trunk roll doing around as you're 20 with no limit to break. And he was too old to rock and roll, oh, but he was too young as the high. Yes, he was too old to rock and roll. I
So you ride yourselves over the fields and you make all your animal deals. And your wise men don't know how it feels to be thick as a
brick.
Them, which immediately then became a much more serious condition, because if I carry on singing now, it's not just a question of doing a terrible show or anything, mm-hmm. It's actually a question of then there being a permanent damage which can only be alleviated by operation. Mm. And I mean, it's not an uncommon operation to have, but it's one that has a certain element of risk that mm-hmm. you don't ever get back to normal after it, and also it means in itself the operations is a couple of months of silence mm. after it. So.
How long do you have between now and the Australian tour?
7 days.
That's it?
Mm. It was going to be five. I mean, that's why I'm flying back to England now, because at least I can stay in one place and in a fairly humid atmosphere for 7 days and then fly on to Sydney.
All right, we're
ready. Okay. Where else? Do we have speed?
So we're going to do this like an interview.
Yeah.
This would, you're going to be swapped for
Carla.
Right. So yeah. I'll talk to you, not to camera. Right. Okay.
Ready? Ian, what does the term progressive rock mean to you?
Well, I think the word progressive in relation to rock always suggests something to do with musicality. There are. I think it also suggests some level of invention, some creativity, something that's a bit special, for want of a better word. But I think it always suggests musicality. Now, whether that musicality is the overblown, overly dramatic, pompous sort of music of bands like Emerson, Lake and Palmer, or Yes, or Jethro, who, you know, from the 70s period, or whether it's actually, shall we say, the more accepted sort of musicality of bands, progressive jazz rock groups like Weather Report or whatever. I mean, it still suggests the ability to play your instrument well, inventively, and to be a sort of master of it. That's really what progressive rock suggests to me. All of that combined with originality and something which is up, is aggressive, and is not perhaps always just the boy meets girl kind of lyrical material. Now, whether or not we could embrace in that such diverse efforts as Sgt. Pepper, which is a classic inventive pop music album, I wouldn't say it was progressive rock, but it's certainly progressive in the sense that it combined a lot of ideas in a pop context that have never really been used before. And obviously it's an incredibly original and beautifully written and executed piece of work. Whether that is progressive rock or whether it's progressive pop, I'm not sure. Again, if you go to the other extreme of, as I mentioned, something like Weather Report, who, again, are progressive, original, and doing something different. But it's not quite, I mean, that again has such an origin in what is accepted, formalized jazz in terms of the background of the musicians. Again, maybe that doesn't fit the bill. So I guess you're left with what seems to be that rather overblown, pompous sort of contribution from the mid-70s groups. Now, I personally believe that in the context of the 1980s, there are bands that still, whether it's fashionable or not to call them progressive rock, I think they still fly that same banner. And, I mean, I would include Thomas Dolby or bands like The Fix, you know, who still demonstrate great musicality and a not quite mainstream approach to pop music. It's still rock music rather than pop to me, what The Fix do. And on their most recent album, Phantoms, the song Phantom Living, which is to me is just on hearing it, I mean immediately, is just great stuff, you know, and I wouldn't just call that, well, just plain old pop music. That's something special, you know, and so I think the flag of progressive rock is still flying, but no one really wants to call it progressive rock music anymore. But it certainly ain't just, you know, common or garden sort of, you know, run-of-the-mill pop music, as far as I'm concerned. There are some special things still happening and always will be happening.
Do you think that that the genre was born from the artist's need to stretch themselves musically?
I think the artists always feel a need to stretch themselves musically. But I think that perhaps the main thrust is something that stems from, I don't know, having gone to art school or had a classical music training or whatever it might be. It comes from a slightly more intellectual standpoint as well. Perhaps when we bear in mind the original notion for this particular program, divulging all our secrets to the viewers now, was that it should be art rock rather than progressive rock. And I mean, the two are, they come very close together in some ways. Art rock, however, is an even more fanciful, an even more limiting description of a slightly different genre than progressive rock is, which I think why we went back with the progressive rock notion as embracing more. But certainly there's that slightly arty sort of thing you can never get away from. And that always brings about a cynical attitude from critics who get a little bit suspicious when anyone involved in the pop or rock music business gets too pretentious. And that's a very good safety valve to have, because otherwise pop music does, from time to time, and one has been guilty of this oneself, let it get way out of control, you know. And that's a lot of fun at the time, but musically and artistically it's a sort of cul-de-sac that you don't want to stay in for too long. So, yeah, sure, playing the instrument is part of it, but I think there's always that slightly artistic pretension which, if you're going to do it, be unabashed about it and have a good time.
Is it, Ian, primarily a British phenomena? And if so, why?
Certainly there seem to be an awful lot of British bands that have taken that route, and I still say are still taking it now, you know, in amongst the new bands too. But I would, you know, throw up names like Captain Beefheart and his Magic Band circa 1973, the Spotlight Kid album. That to me was about something special. It was still, if you were going to call it anything, you still have to call it progressive rock music, I think. It was peculiarly American. I mean, really American music. Obviously, Captain Beefheart was not a hero in this country. We actually took him on tour as a support band once, and he got booed off most nights. I mean, it was very sad because we loved the band, and they were in fact very popular in Britain and elsewhere in Europe. And indeed, I think I've probably spent, without knowing it, have become a very influential band for a lot of groups who are around now who perhaps grew up listening to that music back then, who certainly developed the penchant for calling their musicians by ridiculous names. I mean, Captain Beefheart had a band consisting of Zoot Horn Rollo, Winged Eel Fingerling, Rocket Morton, and people like that, which, I mean, were terrific names, and of course weren't their real names. Everybody thought that was very strange back then. Now, of course, every band uses, once again, far more inventive names than perhaps even than that.
Would you put Zappa in the category of American progressive rock?
I would, but I'm sure he wouldn't, because I think Frank Zappa likes British rock music and doesn't really like being part of anything. He's always seemed to be rather cynical and have a bit of a chip on his shoulder about something, which I don't understand. Never met the man, but again, I would put him as, you know, right up there in terms of American progressive rock music as being a very influential person. Not in as much as his music may have not directly influenced people, but what he stood for certainly influenced a lot of people, including me. So I may not have influenced Frank Zappa, but in his own way, I'm sure he's influenced me and people of, you know, my ilk, who at least felt brave enough to stand up on their own two feet and try and do something a bit more adventurous musically, having seen dear old Frank having a go.
Who do you consider the pioneers of progressive rock?
Well, if you I suppose if you go back to the early things like the early concept albums, like the Moody Blues had a record out called Days of Future Past, which was wasn't something I particularly thought was a great record, but it was of its type. It was something suddenly different. It was that notion of the concept, the overall musical concept in an album, which was very brave, very forward-looking. And from that, a number of bands took that kind of a theme. I suppose the first sort of progressive rock that influenced me in any musical way was very early Pink Floyd, the very first album, Piper at the Gates of Dawn, which I found to be a terrific lesson in combining quirky songwriting with, you know, then amazing sound effects and amazing theatricality on stage. So, although again they were perhaps more in the art rock genre as they were perceived at the time, I mean they were still truly progressive in the sense that it unleashed a whole new kind of influence for a lot of musicians in England. Now the Pink Floyd, I think, in their own little way, were kind of not exactly copying, but certainly paralleling anyway, something that was already happening in the United States at the time. So I guess there were some of those early US bands, I mean, with light shows buzzing around and in the Fillmore's East and West and whatever else, all that was already kind of happening. But the Floyd were the first we really saw of it in Europe anyway, in terms of combining it with a theatrical performance that was more than just pop image. It was a whole new thing, you know. It's quite fun. I always remember meeting Syd Barrett backstage. We were supporting them before we were called Jethro Tull, in some little gig somewhere in the north of England. And it was a pretty seedy place. And this mysterious guy was standing alone backstage, just gazing at himself in a full-length mirror, wearing a cloak with a hole in it, and smoking a small cigar. And I, being a sort of fairly cheerful lad, he went up and said, "Hi, you know, I'm Ian." And he just looked at me with a cold gaze and went back to, you know, combing his hair and preening himself in front of this mirror. And I just thought he was a weird roadie or something. But he then materialized on stage playing a completely out-of-tune guitar with mirrors all over it. And I thought he was great. But anyway, enough storytelling.
Storytelling is always wonderful. Did you set out to...
Especially when you make it up. No, go on.
Did you set out to execute a particular vision for Jethro Tull, or did it just evolve?
No, I think when Jethro Tull first started, we were anything but a progressive rock band, if that is indeed what we are. We began as a blues group, really just doing a lot of very conventional third-hand blues riffs and, in fact, fairly standard stock blues tunes that were the stuff that you played around the blues clubs in England just to make the most basic of livings. And we began early on in our performance to sort of slightly deviate from the mainstream of blues because we introduced some elements of, I was going to say comedy is perhaps not the right word, just irreverency about it. You know, we didn't take it too seriously. And then we started to write a couple of songs of our own that were kind of in a blues vein, but were just slightly away from it enough to make us seem different. And we then, at the time we became popular, we were popular as a blues-based group rather than a purist blues group like the early Fleetwood Mac were, or Ainsley Dunbar or John Mayall or Peter Green, you know, in his sort of later life. And I mean, all of that was very, very purist. We were not by the time we became popular, and so as soon as we got noticed by enough people, we started to rely on our own songwriting, and that took us well away from blues, using other influences, which were... obviously, our music's always been very eclectic, and is so even now. In other words, it uses a lot of influence from a lot of different sources, and we put those together, hopefully not in a pastiche form. We try to make the edges dovetail a bit, you know, but it is nonetheless eclectic. And perhaps that very... eclecticism is something that also is shared by a lot of other bands. Like, again, we, you know, mentioned Yes or Emerson, Lake and Palmer. There are a lot of different things in there, you know, that are coming together sometimes awkwardly, but still with something special going for them. So maybe that that very eclectic nature is a very important thing as well. Sort of almost a clashing of different influences somehow, almost meeting. You know, that can be exciting.
You talked a little while ago about the theatricality of Pink Floyd. How important has it been to Jethro Tull?
Well, theatricality is sort of, it comes with the show in the sense that you go out there on the stage and either you are that way inclined or you're not. And I never rehearse things to do with performance. Sometimes things that involve props or particular stage dressings, I mean, they will get introduced usually the last minute in dress rehearsals, because obviously you can't just suddenly conjure up a piece of staging or flats or special drapes and tabs and things that, you know, literally as you walk on stage for the first time, you've got to build them, you've got to put them together. But we don't always know what we're going to do with them, because I think for me the fun of going on stage is that at least the first night of a tour, you will be doing a lot of improvising. Hopefully you know the music reasonably well, but in terms of the way you perform it, it's just going to be off the wall, you know, for the first couple of weeks. Then the things that begin to click into place, you know, become repeated, they become part of a formulated performance. And that might then suggest that it becomes relatively dull after that and everything settles into a routine. But in its own way, the little routine that you've now built up allows you the security on stage to start looking for other, you know, little things to do, crazy things to do, or subtleties to do. It's a base from which you can then look even further. So the latter parts of tours are often very interesting because you have a pretty standard sort of operating mode then, into which you can perhaps even take more risks or take some more chances and change arrangements of songs or do whatever you do as you go along. So it doesn't become boring, in fact. It just stops becoming so nerve-wracking as it is in the first couple of weeks, when it's just, you don't really know what you're going to say or where you're going to move, and the spotlight operators are, you know, wetting their pants every night because they just never know where you're going to be.
Do you, how much influence do you think that opera had on progressive rock, and does any of your material qualify as rock opera?
Well, I actually don't think that opera ever had any influence on music, full stop. I mean, I detest opera. the term rock opera is something that was coined, I think, before The Who did Tommy, probably going back to, now I can't remember the name, some peculiar thing in Britain that was done was supposedly a rock opera, but it never actually got released as such. It was sort
the
of
The Kinks
done.
And Arthur, or back further than
oh,
that?
Oh, no, no, this is going back a bit further than that. Name escapes me, but obviously the one that everybody remembers is Tommy, and Tommy, I've got a feeling when we did the Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus, which was another of those things that never really happened in the end, and the Who were on that, and I think they were doing stuff then from Tommy, whether it was just in a, it was before the album, I don't know, but it was, I mean, this is going back 1968, 1969, somewhere around there. I'm sure I remember The Who doing some stuff that sounded suspiciously like, sort of, in that vein. Certainly, you know, very conceptual lyrically and all the rest of it. And, but I don't think it had much to do with opera, because it wasn't being theatrically acted out. It was still being performed by a rock group in conventional rock group circumstances. I mean, Roger Daltrey was not dressing up in, you know, in special clothes. It didn't have theatrical sets. It wasn't an opera in that sense. It was, of course, done, I know it was done, because I actually got asked to be one of the, to be something in it. I can't remember what. When they staged it later on in a full theatrically glorious performance in the Rainbow Theatre in London. And I know that, I think they did a few shows where they did Tommy as a full-blown theatrical operatic kind of a thing. I mean, they had people like Richard Harris and you know, proper actors, and plus a lot of singers and whatever, doing it in a very grandiose fashion. As I say, I was asked to do something. I was probably on tour or wasn't available. I didn't even get to see it in the end, but that might have been an attempt to take it into a more theatrical context. But I don't think that ever in the first place it was an opera in the sense that it really was opera. No, don't think so.
Many consider to be Aqualung. That's good English, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Many consider Aqualung to be. Let's try that. Good. Okay. Ian, many consider Aqualung to be Jethro Tull's crowning achievement. Can you tell us about the album?
Aqualung, actually, a lot of people think was a concept album, but in fact, the original, or the title track, derived from some ideas for some lyrics that my then wife had come up with as a result of she was a photography student and had come back with some photographs of various homeless people, you know, old dossers around the sort of East London area, and had penned a few words, you know, which, you know, looked like some good notion for song lyrics, and we kind of, you know, together kind of made a song up out of it. Excuse me. And that particular song and some of the other songs that surrounded the nucleus of the album. I mean, once you've got four or five songs together, you kind of look at it and say, ah, something, you know, there are some common denominators in this lyrical material. So then you perhaps then go and write the extra song so that they fit in some way. But it wasn't a concept album so much as a collection of songs that had a feel about them. What made it look more like a concept album was the execution of the cover, the liner notes, everything kind of just somehow pointing to there being some underlying, you know, celestial theme, you know, some cosmic truth about to be unveiled or whatever. And everybody immediately thought it was a concept album. Well, I mean, that surprised me. And I remember at the time in all the interviews that I did saying, no, it's not a concept album at all. But it doesn't matter whether you say it or not. People, they get there in their heads, they believe it. Whereas Thick as a Brick, the album after that, I then had got, by then, used to the idea that I was supposed to now be the author of concept albums. I thought we'd do one. You know, in fact, we did two. We did Thick as a Brick and Passion Play after it. But again, after that, we got well away from that, went back to just collections of songs again, although I've always felt that striking that middle balance, which I think we did with Aqualung and subsequently with War Child and Songs from the Wood and albums up to the present day, was just that idea of taking a number of songs that you start with, seeing when things start to happen, when you start to get a little few notional, lyrical, common themes, common ideas, then you try and expound on it a little bit. You try and build on that and make your album cover, your design work and the way you do the show. You try and reinforce those original ideas rather than, you know, just spreading them thin. You try and reinforce it. But I don't believe we make concept albums other than those two, and certainly not in the case of Aqualung. What it did do that might have been a little unusual for the time, although people will remember Aqualung as, you know, perhaps Jethro Tull, sort of much more of a rock band. I mean, there were a lot of acoustic songs on the album, interspersed between the heavier songs, and it was probably the first time in I don't know what you would call it, probably contemporary folk influence had somehow lived side by side with heavy rock. And it was always very difficult to make that work on stage, because even now we do concerts, there's a number of people out there who particularly like to hear the acoustic songs, you know, and there are perhaps more people who particularly want to hear the heavy rock songs. And even now there's still that difficulty of making the two things work side by side on a purely practical level, because obviously strumming an acoustic guitar and singing something supposedly gently and emotional is a bit hard to do if you just wrecked your voice screaming the rock song before it. You know, it gets tricky to have the finesse to make those things work together, which is my explanation for the dismal failure that we've been responsible for all these years.
That's not true.
No, I'm being modest, but it's safer.
How is Jethro Tull in the 80s different than Jethro Tull in the 70s and 60s?
I attempt to define that on stage every night to the audience, but I use certain words that are not permissible on daytime television. So I won't, we'll leave it till the late showing. Basically we are older, and being older presumably means that you might be Peter Pan forever, you know, in some ways mentally, when you get up on a stage, but you can't pretend to, you can't have a lifestyle that just forevermore emulates your behavior at the age of 18, 19, 20 or whatever. And obviously you take on responsibilities, marriage, children, overdrafts, mortgages, the usual stuff. And clearly you have to not let that intrude on your music if possible, nor do you really want to reflect it in your music because it's pretty boring stuff. Well, at least the overdrafts are. And you would therefore like to try and separate your life into the side that is practical and, you know, down to earth, normal by most people's standards, and the part of you that is a musician and dealing with that sort of flimsy creative kind of a world. And I think it maybe gets easier as you get older to separate those two things. And people who meet me off stage or backstage or whatever think, oh, you know, cool, isn't he boring? He's a really sort of normal guy, just kind of sits there reading a book or playing table tennis or something. And then suddenly, you know, in that brief moment between getting to the top of the steps that lead to the back of the stage and walking out into the spotlight, something happens, you know. Well, nothing actually happens at all, except I walk into the spotlight. I mean, there's really no difference, but everybody perceives it as being, you know, like a sort of real chameleon change. I think that just gets easier. You get less paranoid about the differences between your private life and your apparent appearance on stage. It fits into place. It maybe gets easier to do in the sense that if you survive the first 10 years of being a rock musician on the road and making records and enjoying some level of success, you'll probably survive the next 10 or 20. Because you probably learn to cope with it most of the time. I mean, I crack up on alternate Wednesdays, but other than that, I'm okay.
Let's talk about some other bands and their effect on progressive rock, if you think they have any. Genesis, how do you think they fit as a band into the whole progressive rock picture?
Well, I never had the fortune to see Genesis in their early days because they began more or less around the same time as we did, and we all seemed to be on tour. You know, the same. I mean, never actually just got to see them, never crossed paths with them at all. We used to hear a lot about them, you know, from promoters and sometimes from fans of the group who would appear to be fans of Genesis as well. I think perhaps there were some similarities between the bands in the early days. They obviously suffered their lineup changes and the change of emphasis in, you know, in the sort of focus of the group, just as Jethro Tull did in its way. But like I said, I think they're probably a very important group. They're one that have survived through ultimately being good musicians, doing a good performance, and obviously it's a band, but you can't escape the fact that Phil Collins as a particularly as a vocalist, I mean, is just really terrific. He's a great, very talented singer. Apart from being a drummer, musician, writer, whatever else he might be, he's a great singer, and it's great to be a great singer. So, I mean, he's always got that talent to fall back on, even without original material, even without perhaps being, if Genesis, and I'm not saying they are, but if they were considered by critics to be no longer in the front ranks of, you know, creative, forward-going groups, at least there is a level of performance, you know, from all of the band, but particularly Phil Collins, even if the only material they had to work with was, you know, Tamla Motown hits of 15 years ago, they would, if that's all they did, they'd still be terrific because they would do it in a great way. It would sound terrific and they would put something special of their own into it. So they have a, you know, a lasting place. But, you know, I mean, I don't want to sound critical of them any more than anybody else, but somehow, bands like the Pink Floyd, for me, still, right up until the last, were still flying in the face of everything that seemed sensible. Same with David Bowie. I mean, David Bowie's great because he's always getting into trouble. I mean, he's always do it. Having been successful, he then seems to really just go the other way, take a different tack, and immediately people, you know, get really upset with him again, which is fantastic. That I really respect. I wish I was as brave, you know. But that I really do respect is when people are capable of about turns in direction, especially when they've been successful, you know, then to say, okay, fine, I've done that, I don't need to do that one again, I'll take a different move this time. I think that's you know, very laudable.
What about King Crimson?
King Crimson, I think, were very interesting at the time they first appeared on the scene. I mean, they came along with early Traffic, Spooky Tooth, Yes, Jethro Tull. All those bands were bands that played at the Marquee Club in London, which spawned, before that, the first wave of blues groups, you know, the Rolling Stones and Alexis Corner and all those guys that began there. Subsequently, the sort of progressive music boom of the late 60s, early 70s, most of the bands we've been talking about have, you know, been marquee resident groups. Crimson, along with Traffic, you know, were two bands that I used to regularly go and see there because they were, a very charged atmosphere when both of those bands played. I mean, maybe it was when we played as well, I don't know, but it was great when they played. I used to go and watch, and it was, you couldn't, you know, what they were playing, again, had that sort of eclectic thing about it. You couldn't quite define where it was all coming from, you know, in terms of influences, but it was a really electric atmosphere. Obviously not as melodic as groups like Yes, not as exciting in terms of virtuosity as the Nice were in those days. When Keith Emerson was throwing daggers into Leslie cabinets. They again were another marquee resident band, you know, at the time we were. But certainly King Crimson had that something special, something pretty tortuous about them and something very unsettled. But so they always gave the impression of being a band that wasn't going to stay intact for very long, you know. As Traffic also seemed very precarious, you know, a band that just somehow looked as if it was going to break apart any second, you know, because it was, on a good night they were just fantastic, on a bad night they were really roping on together, you know, they were very variable, all those bands. Whereas bands like Yes tended to be more consistent, you know, they would not have so many ups and downs, and similarly the Nice were really solid and reliable, you know, neat to the last dagger throw every night, you know, it would be just right.
That's all my questions.
Terrific. Well, we ran out early, didn't we?
No, we've had 25 minutes.
Good.
Can you think of any closing statements?
I mean, I could think of a whole script worth of closing statements, but I'd you know, obviously would love to do that and would love to have had a few things, you know, prepared to have said, which I was going to do today anyway, for tomorrow, mm-hmm. under the original thing, because there were actually a few, I mean, you might as well just stop turning over now, chaps, but the thing that, there were some points in the thing that I managed to get to one of them about the Beatles, which mm-hmm. I mean was that they
yes.
were, certainly they were very influential in pointing the way, but I don't think they were progressive rock. But you did have in the script Spandau Ballet,
mm-hmm.
which I seem to remember we discussed at the time. I mean, not that I'm saying they should be in or out, but I personally find them very difficult to relate to in context. I mean, I was watching a video clip of Spandau on television this morning. I mean, they are arch wimps, you know. I mean, they're really so drippy, it's not true. And so poppy, you know, that, I mean, it's hard to see them in the context. But who have you managed to get additional material of? I mean, you mentioned Dave Gilmour.
David Gilmour, I interviewed today in London today. They did an interview with Jim Capaldi.
Mm-hmm.
We also have an interview with Steve Howe. I believe, I don't have my list in front of me. There's three other interviews that are happening in London besides Capaldi and Steve Howe.
Mm.
And I can't think of
Keith Emerson over here now, because he would have been great.